Today I'm here talking with a few guests. I have Matthias Ferras, a Belgian consultant focusing on DDD. Matthias, how would you kind of categorize your work?
Just general software consultants. There's more than DDD to building software, of course.
And we are joined by Ross Tuck. Ross, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm also a software consultant because that's, you know, the it thing to be these days. And I help people who have got themselves backed into a corner with some legacy or maybe some interesting greenfield work. And sometimes it involves DDD, sometimes it doesn't. It just depends on the situation.
I think that we've all been on multiple DDD podcasts giving kind of the elevator pitch, like what is DDD, when would you use it, etc. I want to kind of get past that a little bit. Maybe, Ross, you could start by telling me something that you feel is misunderstood about DDD.
Well, I mean, the obvious one that everybody highlights is the tactical versus the strategic patterns, that everyone zooms in on the tactical. What is an entity? What is a value object, et cetera? You know, when really the big innovative stuff from DDD in my mind is the strategic stuff, you know, about bounded context and language and making domain models front and center in what you do and capturing that in code. And I think that's actually kind of the interesting stuff. At the same time, I think sort of the second misstep that people often make is thinking that they need to capture exactly what the business is, that they don't think about creating a model, which is a simplification or just the parts that are relevant to the problem at hand, but that they need to model exactly what the business does, that they need to capture reality, which is also, I mean, let's face it, reality is pretty complicated. So I think that those are kind of the big fallacies I often see.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing. It's sort of how people start, like, okay, I have to model the business, or I have to model reality. Of course, what is reality? And people will focus on things. They will look at structure first, and they will model structure, which is fine, of course. It's useful, or it can be useful. We judge our models we should judge them by how useful they are, not by how elegant they are or how well they represent our version of reality. Because if that was the goal, then we risk in building overcomplicated models. But the sort of thing that I've been involved with lately, especially with the sort of projects or clients I've been involved with, is to start looking less at the things and more at sort of the processes that are going on. And that's going to be my focus for modeling things nowadays. So I guess a good example would be, let's say you have some insurance policy. We could model that as a thing, as a document, which it is. There is some document involved. There is some place where the specifics of this contract have been written down or stored in the system. But there's the two most interesting things about it is that, first of all, there's this kind of process leading up to this artifact, this process of agreeing on what this document should look like, basically the negotiation between, in this example, a client and the insurance agent. And then there's a second process, which starts whenever somebody enters makes a claim. So maybe they have some issue and they make a claim for insurance money. This is another process that starts. So I would be a lot more interested nowadays, especially in these kinds of complex business domains, in capturing these two processes instead of that document itself.
So is the process of modeling significantly different if you're focusing on the workflows, the processes in the domain, rather than just the entities?
Yeah, exactly. This is, like, if you talk to a business, they will say, well, we're doing this where, you know, the client comes in and we're negotiating, and they're describing these processes, and they say stuff like, when this happens, then, you know, this should happen as well. And then we go to our whiteboards or to our code, and we only remember the nouns, and we start making objects for, you know, customer and contract and the nouns they mentioned, but we sort of ignore the whole process they describe. So we start building this, and it's not just developers, it's analysts as well. We the sort of stories we get from analysts, usually they start with as an insurance agent, I want to see a list of clients. That's very state focused and very structure focused. And then of course people build this whole thing. They build all the sort of setup that you need. And when you get to the point of actually adding the features that are important. I think this process of receiving a claim and maybe validating if that claim is it's not fraud or anything. Or this whole process. When we get to the point that we have to implement this process, we have this entire structural model that was actually not built for it. It was not built for purpose. And that's where we often go wrong.
Do you have any tricks or tools to help us focus on modeling these processes, these workflows?
I'm a big fan of event storming, of course. It's a way of looking at the events first and finding domain events. So process is just a bunch of events, a bunch of things happening over time. Time is critical here. A lot of business processes have this implicit element of time. You don't make this contract and get a claim and everything in the same sort of millisecond. This can take days or weeks, or in the case of some insurance policies, they last multiple years. Some products like life insurance, they take very long. So what I look for first is what kind of events happen over time. Before I even start looking for the policies, that's my main focus, and then I start to group them in processes and policies influencing processes, contracts influencing processes. So that's another version of reality. It's closer to the domain that we're modeling in this case. So I would say that this is probably a better suitable model for insurance.
You're talking a lot about events here. Does it seem like everything that we're doing now is event-driven? I've been getting a lot into functional reactive programming, and just everything I'm doing seems like it's about events.
Ross, want to take this?
This is an interesting one to me because I think it highlights sort of a change in DDD. We started off with the Java type structural models and so on and so forth. And then over time, we've gotten more into this temporal aspect, right? And event sourcing CQRS was the big shift there. That's something I've done a little bit less of, to be quite honest. I mean, a lot of my work is still where perhaps it's not a good fit. And I think we're still finding what a good fit is for those. I don't think that we know all the trade-offs yet for temporal-based models. And I think that they're probably good fits for some things and I don't want to say bad fits, but lesser fits for other things. So to be honest, it's like, for me, it's an interesting topic, but it's not one where I feel like I'm going to give you a lot of input about how to do it. I think that when you're doing the temporal models, then you need to embrace a lot of eventual consistency. That works great with the distributed the distributed systems that we're working with these days. But it comes with a different set of constraints. I definitely see that becoming more and more of a big deal in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. There's places where this is going to be very relevant, this temporal model. There's places where it would just be overcomplicating everything, of course. And of course, I'm biased because I got into event sourcing and then I started talking about it and people started hiring me for the kind of problems where event sourcing is relevant. But I do agree with you, Sean, that there is some shift going on. It's not just event sourcing in the DDD world, but functional reactive programming. There's the Reactive Manifesto. There's a conference like ReactConf last year in London that talks simply about this stuff. How will we deal with events? With more and more of these events, we have, by 2020, I think the prediction is that we will have 75 billion connected devices. That will include your microwave and your shoes and your watch and everything. And it's constantly measuring stuff and sending out events and signals more than we can handle on a single machine, definitely more. If we want to extract meaningful data from that, we will need ways to distribute that and to still be able to have fast response times where we need it, get accurate data, etc. So dealing with lots and lots of events is going to be is clearly going to be a bigger problem in the near future. And of course, processes are not getting faster. The free lunch is over. So we will need to spread it out over multiple, more and more machines, actually. Which is why I got interested in Erlang as well. It's sort of the best language to do this kind of stuff in.
bit of a tangent here, actually, but I'm curious about why do you guys think it is that events have come to such a peak or such an ascendance here? Because there's a lot of really nice things about them, right? They're easy to understand. They're a really great building block to communicate with the domain experts and non-technical people about. I mean, everybody understands time to some degree. And this idea of, well, message passing, basically, it's really, really powerful. It works great for distributed systems. But I still find it interesting that it all seems to be centered around events, especially when you look at it on a small scale. I talk to a lot of people who don't really like event-based programming. They find it complicated. But, you know, the results that you get from it are hard to argue with.
Yeah, I think the more interesting question might be why we haven't done it that way for so long. I think that this is a natural way of doing things and that we sort of didn't have the technology to do it. We couldn't store all the changes to our data because storage was expensive. We couldn't communicate all the changes because communication was more expensive. If we look at if we get back to, you know, thinking about modeling the real world, how does the real world work? We communicate by message passing. As I'm speaking, I'm passing messages to you guys and to everybody who's listening. I'm not in your head modifying state directly. We don't share state here. I just pass these messages. It's just bits of information, small bits of information, and I do not control. I don't even control whether you receive it. Most people in the world are not listening to this podcast, for example. And I'm not controlling how it affects you. You might be just ignoring it or disagreeing it or have this life-changing revelation. That's message passing. And it's not just between humans. It's any kind of system in physics. We could say that light and sound and all these things are just signals. They're just message passing. And they are events in the sense that you only know about something after it happened. It could be fractions of milliseconds, but it is after it has happened. That makes it an event. When I see a car crash, the moment this information reaches my brain, it's already happened. And in extreme cases, if we look at the stars, they may not even exist anymore. This message passing is slower, of course, because they're more remote. But even in very direct conversation, by the time some message reaches your brain, it's already over. So I think that's why events are such a natural fit for many kinds of problems.
When we make updates to like shared state in a typical application, it's more often than not impossible to pull events out of it. However, we can take events and then generate state without much difficulty. So just like in event sourcing, we go through the events, update the state accordingly for each event, and then we have the state. Can we think of anything that's maybe more atomic than events, something that we can use to look at the problem in a different way?
Command?
I would say, well, I'd say they're sort of on the same level, commands and events. They're both messages. They have a different intention. A command is something that hasn't happened that you want to happen, whereas an event is something that has happened. If you want to find something more granular, it's just values, I would say, attributes of this event or command. So, you know, something has happened. Where did it happen and when did it happen? And any kind of who did it happen to? This sort of information is, I guess, the smallest you can get. Well, you can go down to the bit level or to the electron level, of course. But
but we don't want to model reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? But I do think it's interesting because an event, right, it assumes that something came before it. Like, at least without getting into quantum stuff here, you know, an event is always preceded by a cause, which we normally call a command. But it is interesting to me that one person's event is another person's command. Like that event has repercussions and it trickles through the system and it causes other things to happen, like dominoes. So really, I think maybe sometimes the distinction between command and event, yes, we often, you know, we want to build a separate layer. We want to translate from one model to another because we get an event in, but we change that to a command. But really, we're looking at like these massive, massive chains of cause and effect. And that to me is really interesting, exciting, because that is how the real world works, but it's also a very easy model to make simplifications in. right? We can cut out entire subsections of that model, which are just not interesting to us. So that's a really useful tool.
Yeah, I'm intrigued now. Would you have examples of how an event, you say an event for somebody could be a command for somebody else?
I wouldn't necessarily like it take the event directly in as a command and just pass it onwards. Typically, there's a transformation. But if you were using like a really tight relationship, like a conformist, I mean, you could do it theoretically, I guess. But let's say an example, like we were talking about insurance earlier. Let's say I walk into an insurance brokerage in my hometown. I fill in a piece of paper and, you know, that paper is in real life, it's paperwork, but in our terms, it's a message, right? We fill it out and we hand it over to the broker. And the broker is going to go and send that off to somebody at the head office who's going to calculate what my policy would be based on my health profile and so on. Now, for the broker, like receiving that, he's received a piece of paperwork, right? He's received my application. For him, that could arguably be an event, like application received. Then that's going to, because he's received it, that's caused him to go ahead and pass that off to the head office. And for those people, they say, oh, application received at head office. Now we need to calculate a policy and so on and so forth. That's very, very loose terms, obviously. But this is a model of cause and effect for me, that it stretches over multiple pieces, bound to context, systems, you name it.
Yeah, but I would still, in my system, well, as you suggest, model as two separate things. It would be a contract received and then... What was the example you gave?
Determine policy or something. Yeah.
So that would be a command again. So this is the fundamental idea of reactive systems. It's stuff happens and other stuff reacts to it. And sometimes you could react by just doing something straight away, changing some state or having some other side effect. Or you could decouple from basically the decision to react to something to the decision of whether that new command actually should be executed. So might be I receive some event, something has happened. When this thing has happened, then I tell somebody else, do this. But again, this is just a message. I don't know when I say calculate policy or calculate price, whether they will actually do it and what their end result will be. So this sort of decoupling is, I think, a very powerful aspect of reactive systems, because it's not just temporal decoupling in the sense that things happen and other things happen without them having to happen directly at the same time. It's messages on a queue. Mm-hmm. But it can even be a sort of linguistic decoupling. It could be a completely decoupled models where in your world, you're describing things this way. I'm telling this other system, this has happened, therefore now you have to do this. This other system could have a whole different model of reality, of their subset of reality that is important to them, with a different ubiquitous language, with a different way of describing these things. And there's nothing in between that needs to know both, except for this one little process that needs to understand events from one system and commands to another system, but that's it. That's a very thin layer of knowledge that bridges these two systems. So that's I would say one of the most powerful aspects of reactive systems.
Absolutely, like that ability to isolate those decisions and to have them transform over time, but also be able to trace that lineage. Like that's a really, really powerful tool, to, I think, to a lot of people to see this stuff. And it works at a high level, it works at a low level, and that's kind of the thing you're looking for in a model, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you're talking about this thin thread between models, how does that manifest?
I think in DDD terms, like the closest thing you might see it in is something like an anti-corruption layer where, you know, we get something in from one bounded context or even within our own. I mean, a controller would be another example of that. And we transform it from an HTTP request to a command internally or vice versa. So, I mean, you guys have been doing a lot more with functional lately, for example. I mean, a lot of it is series of transformations. And I think that same principle applies. And I think it's fascinating anyways, if you look at these things at sort of an object level, or you look at them at an infrastructure level, or you look at them at an organizational level, then many of the same patterns apply. You still have the same concerns about chattiness, about coupling, about consensus, dependencies.
Matthias, you give workshops and you do consulting. So I'm sure in the workshops, you're dealing with some more introductory concepts. And then while you're consulting, you're maybe getting down into business and getting into more advanced concepts. When you're actually kind of teaching some of these things, are there some aspects of DDD that you feel take people a while to adapt to?
It really depends on this example I was giving of insurance. I was actually at a large Dutch insurance company the past couple of weeks. And a lot of the things I was talking about with this decoupling and these processes over time, that really hit home with them. For them, it just made so much sense. I've also been at places where I guess the level is different, or where we really need to start with basic stuff, value objects, etc., to sort of get them into the mindset of, you know, you are allowed to think about language. You are allowed to think about the business and understand that there's many environments where people have been actually demotivated from trying to understand the business. Like, no, don't bother with this stuff. We're just going to tell you what to write. Don't try to understand this stuff. You wouldn't understand it anyway. You're just a developer, something like that. And that can really have a nasty effect on culture. So this core idea, when I tell people sometimes who are completely not in the software world, and I try to explain what I do, like I get people who build software projects to understand the business they're building the projects for. They're like, yeah, so isn't that obvious? And it isn't obvious for some reason in our industry. But it's lots of stuff. Like I was in a call this morning with a client where I'm going next week, and they were basically the problem there is they have a legacy system that they, well, inherited. Most of the original people are not there anymore. And when they ask for new features, the developers say, well, we can't do it. It's too hard. This architecture doesn't support it. And then they say, okay, but can we fix the architecture? No, it's too expensive. Well, we have the money. We will pay for it. And then they're stuck because they actually don't know how to fix this legacy system, fix the architecture, fix the code at test. We've never been educated to do that. We've never been focused on that. So even though we know that the system is hard to work with, we don't really know how to fix it. So sometimes my job is nothing more than, you know, giving people the confidence that, yes, you can fix this stuff. Yes, there are ways. There are existing techniques that you can learn, that you can read about to start, evolving your system and make it, bring it back to some state of maintainability. So there's lots of things where it really depends on every context is different and every environment has a different culture, of course.
What about you, Ross? When you got started, was there anything that just took a little bit of time to really click for you?
I think in terms of dealing with clients, then one of the ones I've had to deal with lately is eventual consistency is a big point for people. Because at a low level, often you want to put a transaction over two things. You should decouple them. You should try to over two different aggregates. But they're like, but it's in the same database. I can get a transaction. Why should I put an event in here and then wait for all of that to resolve? I just want to reallocate something, blah, blah, blah. So I think that depending on where you're at with that, that can take some time. Beyond that, I think getting people to really, really care about the ubiquitous language sometimes is an issue, like Matthias said. It seems sometimes like a pointless exercise, but I think it's one of the most powerful ways that we have to refine models over time to make people actually use it and test it and probe it and work with it. But making people realize the value in that can be a process.
Sometimes it's enough to just sort of point out some obvious places to bring in this ubiquitous language. There was an example on the mailing list somewhere, I think, or on Stack Overflow this morning. And somebody had written something like set project as active command. If you just rename that to activate project, then suddenly this clicks like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, it doesn't have to be setter based or add comment to project or something. It's comment on project. That's what you're doing. You're commenting on this project. You're activating this project. So just getting people to sort of make that click about language that it's, you can make it richer. You can find the real way that people would describe it. Just getting them to that point usually is, when you get there, it makes an amazing difference. People start understanding the point of this stuff.
I agree. Like the whole intention revealing interfaces stuff, right? I mean, that is, I think, one of the easiest way to get people into DDD and realize the value of it. And it reduces the translation barrier almost instantly. So it's a great starting point, I think. And I was doing a workshop last week, actually, where we had people in the crowd who at a certain point, as we were discussing the model in the workshop, they wanted to start to diverge. They wanted to use a different term than the one I had in my slides and in the sample code. And I said, okay, we'll do that. But in exchange, we're going to do this like you would in a real project. Anytime I accidentally slip and say the other word, you have to yell at me as a group. You have to start screaming, no, it's this instead. And, you know, they did actually. I think the last couple hours of the day, they were a little bit more tired, so it didn't quite have the same enthusiasm. But I thought it was a really great exercise. And we kept a nice like board of, hey, these are the terms we're using. This is the current state of the ubiquitous language. Pop quiz. What does this mean? What does it mean? How does it differ from what they said? You know, like if you drill people on this, I think it's a really, really great technique to reduce those communication barriers. But again, it's something you only get if you use it over time and exercise it and work with it.
I haven't worked for a client that was a really super good fit for DDD, something that like had a lot of business rules that were changing and everything was in flux and needed to be unraveled. Yet I think that pursuing DDD really kind of helped me learn a lot of new perspective that I could use when, you know, kind of modeling processes and modeling objects in general. What do you think about the value of studying DDD, even for maybe people who aren't in a position to really use it for their clients or for their work?
I think like one thing I would love to have is a better set of interview skills, like whether or not you're going to apply DDD to something, because maybe it's not an important part of the business or anything like that. I think it's really, really great to be able to interview people and get a feel for what they're thinking, what they care about, even if it's generic. What are the important parts? And like I would love to have, and I know this kind of runs counter to the idea, but I would love to have like an interview cookbook for developers, for talking to domain experts. You know, like what are some of the little linguistic tweaks that we all look for, that we all have our own thing, right? You know, like, oh, they said, like Matthias said earlier, like they say when this happens. You know, for us, that's a cue, like a domain event maybe. Or when somebody mixes up indefinite or definite articles like the apple versus a apple, that might be a clue, depending on plural singular rules in English, about whether or not this is a value object or an entity. Do they care about discerning identity between these things? Those sort of interview skills, whether or not you're applying DDD all the way down to the code level, but just empathetically understanding what people want and what they're after, I think that's a skill that goes very, very far, and not just dev, but in almost anything you'll do in your professional life.
I think that's teachable. Actually, there's a lot of questions that I sort of have that always come back, like what changes and who changes it and why do they change it and what does it change into and how often does it change and for what reason does it change? Yes. If you start asking these questions, this already gives you a wealth of information that you don't get if you just ask stuff like, how many of this thing can be, or is this a many-to-many relationship or very structural things like that? If you ask how often does it change, then maybe you can discover that it only changes at very specific times, at very specific points in a process. That might be an indication that, again, I'm back at the processes here, that maybe those are two processes, one of where a lot of change happens and maybe another process where the change has already happened, but something happens now as a consequence of those changes. So that's sort of the first things I'm going to look for when talking to domain experts.
Definitely. I think it's interesting too, because a lot of the DDD practitioners I talk to, they have their own linguistic drivers. Like there's not a master set of those. And I agree with you. I think it's a teachable thing. And maybe a really good thing to focus on in the future, because I think one of the weak points of DDD, and you guys will probably yell at me about this, is that I think it emphasizes the importance of domain models, but there's not quite enough guidance on creating domain models. Like even the bounded context to me, like a bounded context is like a delimited area where I'm going to apply this model. And that has a lot of consequences. It's an important decision. But how did I get to that point to have a domain model in the first place? And I think that's something where we could all use a lot more guidance on, and I think comes down to the core of using it effectively.
Yeah. Well, there is some stuff in Eric Evans' book about evolving domain models and trying to express deeper insights in them. But I think maybe people who get interested in domain-driven design, to sort of shift the blame in the other direction, is that don't expect to learn everything from one book. A lot of very good stuff has been written about modeling and about object-oriented programming and about analysis. And if we just depend on one book to tell us everything, you know, I hate it when people call Eric Evans' book the Blue Bible or something, because it is not a Bible. It's just a set of ideas, a snapshot of some ideas at that point in time. And Eric would probably be the first to admit that. There's other books. There's the books that came before it, like Rebecca Weirs-Brock. I think it's called Object Roles and Responsibilities. There's Object Thinking. There's books on agile modeling. There's all the sort of failed or half-failed experiments that we did. Well, not that I was involved with, but that the software industry tried, like UML and model-driven architectures and sort of more generic ways of trying to capture one modeling style or one universal modeling language to do everything with, and then generate code from that, which still might work for, you know, I like domain-specific languages where you make this very specific, but I don't think it could work for a generic language that you can use to capture all problems. That's just a generic programming language. But not to get sidetracked, there is a lot of stuff. I'm thinking of Analysis Patterns by Martin Fowler, for example, which is basically a book of with some domain models that he built for actual businesses that he just publishes as you would never just take those literally and copy them in your project. But if you read that book, you see how, you know, a brilliant man like Fowler builds a domain model. That's something you can learn from. So let's not be over-dependent on one book, is my point.
No, I agree with you perfectly. Like, I think that these things all complement really, really well. I mean, like some of the stuff that we've talked about previously, you mentioned event storming earlier. I think that's a great tool to help build a model out. You know, the stuff that Constantine is working on with the modeling by example and stuff, I think it's you know, it all complements really, really well. And there will be different ways to do that, and they're companions, not replacements and not supplements.
You mentioned that the Blue Book was kind of a snapshot of the ideas at the time. How has DDD changed since the Blue Book?
Well, I do agree that in the Blue Book, the domain expert is sort of this magical person who knows everything. A lot of what the community has been doing is sort of agreeing that there are also, you know, fallible beings who might not know everything, who might be experimenting with their business. Maybe it's a startup and they are inventing this new domain. And in any case, they're going to try to be, you know, to compete with other businesses by innovating. So a lot of the evolution and event storming is one of those things. Has been about how can we get better at learning from the domain expert. Event sourcing and CQRS, those are just, I think, the main, the chief innovations in domain-driven design, to sort of focus on these things. I think there's been some evolution, especially in moving away from object-oriented, or maybe not just moving away, but sort of adapting more functional principles in domain-driven design. There are some of them in the book, actually. Pure functions are described there. Well, value objects would be sort of a kind of functional idea wrapped in objects. And there's some more like higher order stuff. And some of these things are described in the book without being very explicit about being about functional programming. What we see nowadays is that, for example, in the F-sharp community, domain-driven design is getting a lot of traction. Part of the reason is probably that domain-driven design has always been popular in the C-sharp community. And, of course, many of these people are moving on to F-sharp, especially in finance. So there's a couple of people who have been writing and speaking about building domain models in F-sharp. And the way you do it there is to, using the type system, it has a very rich type system, basically describe your domain model, describe the legal states, which makes it impossible to represent illegal states in your code. So when you are actually writing code that uses this typed domain model, then the compiler is going to tell you whether you're doing it right or wrong. So either you made a mistake in the types, of course, or you're just making a mistake in the code. I'm not an F-sharp expert at all, but I hear it's a very pleasant way of working with this. You think about your model without even writing code at that point, but you're writing something down that is... You give more information about your model to the compiler, really. So it becomes one of these things that help you do your job. In the same way that we do it with test-driven development, with DDD, you are describing the outcomes you expect, and then you just drive your implementation by fixing all the red tests without having to think that much about it anymore. So the same kind of ideas of domain-driven design are being transported into this completely different languages than object-oriented. The fact that the book by Eric Evans is mostly about objects is just, again, a sort of the fact that that was the primary paradigm at that point in time.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the big innovation on the technical level there has been the rise of CQRS and event sourcing and so on, and that's had big effects there. I think also industry-wide trends like functional is just becoming bigger everywhere we go. That's going to just continue to be a huge force to be reckoned with, and we're developing new tactical patterns that work well with functional because, as you said, it was object-oriented at the time. I think that at that time, 2004 or so, you were sort of trapped in that Java OO world. And it's kind of a response to that. It exists within that area. At the same time, I think DDD is interesting because one of the arch rules is that like you can't decouple the implementation from the model, that they have influence on each other. And so occasionally we get these extra tactical patterns or these industry-wide trends that DDD gets swept along in. And those come back and they change the way we look at some of the other stuff. Like the way CQRS and event sourcing came about, I think that was also due to the rise of the domain event as a tactical pattern, and it created this interesting feedback loop, which I really like. You have these very small changes and they have big repercussions over time. But DDD will keep, like the core of it, I think will stay not mostly the same, but the principles will hold very true. But the evolution of different tactical patterns in different environments, that will help keep it fresh, keep it relevant.
Do you think that perhaps languages that have strong typing systems are better for domain modeling?
I wouldn't go as far. I know many people who would say that. And I understand their point of view. Working with a rich type system is very rewarding and pleasant. But to get back to Erlang, which is, it is a typed language to some degree, but it definitely is not as rich or as powerful as in other languages. But in that case, there's a very good reason for that, because Erlang was built to make systems that keep on running forever, that don't go down, that you can upgrade while they are running. You might, in fact, have been in a phone call at many points in your life where some system was being upgraded or replaced while your call was still going on. That's the sort of problems that Erlang is meant to solve. If your system, while it's in this transition state of parts being upgraded and parts that haven't upgraded yet, and we're talking about large distributed systems here, if now you get all kinds of errors because in one part types are like this and in another part the types have already been upgraded to this other structure, this would break a lot of things. That's precisely what they don't want. In Erlang, they want stuff to crash. In fact, it's the first thing you think about when you build an Erlang system would be, how can I know something will fail. I don't know what will fail. I'm not trying to do defensive programming, but I'm trying to isolate all the places where something could fail, whatever it is, so that when it fails, I can restart that process isolated without affecting anything else and just get it back to its last known working state and take it from there. And the same mechanism is actually used for upgrading the system, where you would have basically two versions of the same. So you have a process running, you start the new version of the same process, you tell the old one to send its data, its state over to the new one converts it to its own format, if it's different from the old format, and then the old process is killed off. Or you could even migrate back if there's like a do a rollback if there's some problem. But all of this is not dependent on types. So your model there is, it's a different way of thinking about it. You're modeling these small, processes in the system. In Erlang, you can easily have hundreds of thousands of concurrent processes. So it's very cheap. That's a different way of thinking about a domain model than a structural bunch of types, really. So I wouldn't go as far as to say that types are the one and true answer, as some people are advocating. It's just there will always be probably different ways of looking at systems and modeling systems, and what my approach is basically to learn a bit about all of them and try to find the right tool for the job, of course.
Okay, so we're getting kind of close to our agreed upon time limit. Is there anything that we want to talk about quickly before we kind of wrap up here?
Well, for me, the big news, and for you, Sean, of the week, is that we've just launched the Domain-Driven Design Europe conference. It's going to be in Brussels, in Belgium, in January 2016. We have Eric Evans, the author of the original Domain-Driven Design book, as our first speaker that we announced. And we have some great plans and some lot of speakers and ideas and things that we are not going to announce yet. But keep an eye on the website, dddeurope.com, and the Twitter account is ddd_EU, and you'll know all about it.
Yes, it's just going to be an absolutely excellent event. Thank you both so much for having this conversation with me.
My pleasure.
Likewise.